Hello and welcome to the latest exciting installment of the Bad Wilf podcast. On this episode, we're joined by comedian and author Alistair Beckett King.
So I'm now joined by Alistair Beckett King. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you, Martin. How are you?
I'm all right. Doing well. Enjoying the weather. It's nice and sunny where I am.
Is it?
Yeah. Where are you? I didn't ask where you're based.
I live in southeast London, I'm afraid.
Okay. I'm in Surrey.
Ah. Well, I like the weather at the moment. I think of myself as being a man for one season, basically, which is autumn. But there is, in spring, about a week where I can just about get by and it's not too hot. Because yeah. I'm a redhead, you see, so I can't really do the summer.
Well, yeah, exactly. I've got to be careful now because I've lost all my hair. So that brings a whole new challenge.
You've got to oil that.
Yes.
You've got to get all the essential creams on there.
Exactly.
Oh, not oil. I don't mean oil.
So you're here to promote your new tour, Interdimensional ABK. How did this come to be?
Well, the title of the tour is the Interdimensional ABK. And pretty much what I wanted to do was a show that had a ludicrously over-animated intro. And so I created a little animation in the style of Thundercats and other 80s kids TV shows with me as a sort of, I suppose, kind of Doctor Who-like superhero, an interdimensional traveler who is heroic in a very vague and unspecified way. And that took ages to do that because animation is slow. And I think I hoped that the rest of the show would simply tumble into place as long as I overcommitted to doing the intro. Unfortunately, it has, and the rest of the show is quite good, but it was touch and go for a while. For a while, the intro was the only good bit.
How do you approach writing a stand-up show? Because I get how somebody might write a book or a TV series.
Well, I don't know a lot about writing TV series. I have written a book, and it's really different. I think some people do approach stand-up shows with the full knowledge of where it's going and, you know, structural ideas like, you know, this is the theme and this is what we're going to learn and all the rest of it. But I think a lot of comedians do it the way I do it, which is simply coming up with jokes, building on those jokes, noticing which jokes fit together and which jokes don't fit together, and letting the sort of rhythm of the show come out of how I don't know enough about music, but I think it might be kind of like how you would structure an album. So that, like, you know, this bit feels like it needs to be at the start. This bit's obviously dependent on other things, so that needs to be towards the end. Hopefully the whole thing has a sort of satisfactory sense of conclusion without it necessarily being a narrative or a story or anything like that.
How do you workshop that? Do you perform it in front of friends or do you do like a work in progress gig?
Yes, it's work in progresses and new material nights. And new material nights, you know, there are loads of them all over the country and they're a fun thing to go to because it's nice to see it going wrong sometimes, I think. It's nice to see a good comedian not doing well in a way. And I don't just mean that it's like, ah, ha, 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 ha. So they're not magic either. I mean that it's nice to see behind the curtain, I suppose, see how it works or see... Sometimes to see a comedian doing a bit and it isn't really working and then later on you see their show and it's in the show and it works now. And you go, oh, okay, so between then and now you've made that work and that's become a strong bit.
Is it sometimes just the way you pronounce a word or like the emphasis you put on a certain word?
Yes, it can be that. It can be things like the order in which the information arrives. Stand-up is very much about surprise. Like comedy is more about surprise than other narrative media. Usually in stories you want to give people the information they need, and constantly surprising the reader or the viewer, it's kind of annoying because it's very easy to surprise someone in a drama. You just don't tell them information and then go, ha ha ha, you didn't know this thing that I didn't tell you, I'm a genius. And it's how everybody writes student films. It's how I wrote student films. A bit of an adolescent way of trying to tell a story, I think. But with comedy, you need to surprise people some of the time, at least, because that's how punchlines work, usually. But I found with some stories, I need to take what I think is the punchline and let people know that it's coming, because it's too weird or too surprising if it's a true story. It's a piece of crucial context. that I thought would be a funny punchline turns out to be something you actually need as the setup to enjoy the entire story.
All right. That is interesting. I've always wondered, like, my friend who I mentioned to you before we started recording, I'm often bugging him. I'm fascinated by stand-up and how somebody gets up there and just performs and how it all works. And I guess it is kind of like music. It's kind of like a symphony, I guess.
Yeah, and some people are jazz musicians, yeah. And some people are jazz comedians, and some people really are just playing on stage. And it really, you know, some people really do produce huge amounts of stuff just off the top of their head, just in the moment, and it goes away and it never comes back. And most comedians do a little bit of that and write a lot of stuff. The writing might happen partly on stage, and the writing might start out as a riff. Most people are somewhere between. It's all perfectly scripted, and it's just all freewheeling.
How's it been post-COVID?
Well, it's been nice to get back into rooms. I mean, I say that with qualifications. It hasn't been that nice. It's been a bit weird. But in terms of audience reception, I think people are excited to be back in a live event, you know, in general. I think things are weird ways, things are a bit rowdier. I think audiences are perhaps disruptive, but not in a deliberate or conscious way. I think we've all sort of got used to being on our own.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we've got used to being back in public again.
2 years of not minding our manners, I guess.
Yes, yeah. I'm trying to be polite. What I mean to say is that I despise the general public, but please come to my show.
Yeah, please do. So you've got an excellent podcast called Lawman that looks back at like mythology. Oh, I can't even speak today. It looks back at history.
Legends. Yes.
How did you get involved with that?
Well, I do that podcast with James Shakeshaft, I was going to say erstwhile friend, but that would mean we're not friends anymore, wouldn't it? my once and current friend, James and I started stand-up around about the same time, and it was his idea. He wanted to do a podcast. We were living fairly near each other. I was at the bottom of the hill. James was at the top, slightly posher part of South London. Only very slightly posher, to be clear. We're talking about Thornton Heath. He doesn't live there anymore. It's not that posh. it got less posh when he left. Yeah, he wanted to do a podcast about folklore and legends because he knew I was into that sort of thing. So for the first series, we came and did it talking into a Yeti mic in his kitchen with the quality of acoustics you would associate with both the Yeti mic and recording in a large, spacious room. So it just started out like that. And we did it for years before anybody started listening. So and it was, again, during lockdown when we saw numbers for the podcast go up a little bit, which was nice. And We had a following before, so we've got the loyal fans who were there when it sounded like we were recording from the inside of a iron drum, and we've got the Johnny Come Lately fans who are also extremely welcome. Thank you for being on the Patreon, Johnny Come Latelys. We like you. We like you better than the other ones.
So I've got to ask, because I'm a Doctor Who fan. You were involved with Doctor Who Redacted. What was that like?
It was really nice. I was very surprised to get the offer. I mean, I was involved. I had a handful of lines, a very, very few lines. I think you can hear me pretending to be a Welsh newsreader in one episode and being a few other incidental characters and being a thing called the floater, which I suppose without spoilers explain what the floater is. I'm not sure I can explain what the floater is, but it's pretty interdimensional, but quite small. And that was a surprise. Yeah, especially because, you know, my editor said, there's this LGBTQ+ Doctor Who podcast. Do you want to be in it? And I was like, do you know that I'm not really LGBTQ? I mean, I'm very much pro LGBTQ. Yeah. But he's like, is that mother? Are you sure? And they were like, yeah, but it's three lines. I was like, okay, then yes. Yes, please. So it was nice, and I know some of the other people who worked on it. I've got a chance to have a little chat with Ken Cheng, the comedian who wrote one of the episodes. A very good episode, I think. And of course, Jacob Hawley was a prominent role in it. So yeah, I felt very lucky, and I really enjoyed it. It's nice knowing nothing really about what it was going to be like, having only seen a few pages of the script. I listened to it and I was really impressed. I think they came up with a very clever, it reminded me, and I mean this as a positive, although it might sound like a negative, of escape room experiences and FMV games where they have to come up with a narrative device that means that you, an ordinary person, are involved in this, you know, major sci-fi crisis. And the concept they came up with for Redacted for three unknowns who aren't part of the Hooniverse previously, three people who are, you know, relatively ordinary people to have a Doctor Who related adventure. It's a very cunning and original way of doing it, which is, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, essentially, the Doctor is missing and anybody with any association with the Doctor is sort of winking out of existence, which means that the only people who have a chance to deal with this crisis are the people who have heard of the Doctor and their blue box, but have no actual contact. So it's about three sort of conspiracy theory podcasters investigating what's going on, which is, I think that's really clever.
Yeah. Were you a fan of the series before?
I have to admit that I didn't really watch it before Russell T. Davis brought it back.
Oh,
I watched some of, oh, okay. Cause you know, people will be like, oh yes, but if you'll remember when he went to the mines of Azathoth, and I'll be like, I don't know what happened then. I did watch John Pertwee's series when I was a kid because they happened to be on, and I've caught bits of Tom Baker here and there. And obviously a huge fan of Tom Baker's performances in everything in general. But I am I'm a New Who fan. New Who? Is that what we call it?
Yeah.
It's pretty old now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we're about the same age. So we would have been very young when it was cancelled.
So I certainly don't remember Sylvester McCoy or any of them.
So you've got a background in video game development. So how did you make the transition from that?
Big question. A lack of commitment? Was that just a short attention span? I don't know. Yeah, in about 2016, I was in a... I went to film school. I came to London to study film at the London Film School. And I spent years trying to make short films. And I made a couple of video games after that. And I started comedy. I did about three of these things all at the same time. You know, I had a film going into festivals and I was kickstarting a video game, which is a sort of crowdfunder, very popular with video games. And I started going to open mics. And I think what I was doing was, I don't know, you just knock on a lot of doors sometimes when you've got ideas and see which ones open. And the film door remained resolutely shut to me. I did make a video game. It was very hard work. I worked with wonderful people on it. And it's overall been an extremely positive experience. People still buy it. They still play it. I still make little royalties off it. So which shocks me because I didn't expect any of that. But you know, it's a little indie point and click adventure game. Unless you were into that thing specifically, you wouldn't have heard of it. You know, it's not one of the major smash hit games. But it gave me a chance to write for some other games, and I like that. I don't think the comedy industry, the film industry, video games, they're all extremely separate. You know, there's very little overlap, and there are few people who hop between them. Comedy to acting, I suppose, is more common. Comedy to directing does happen, which is what I was thinking when I started doing comedy, that somehow I'd sort of con my way into being Terry Gilliam or something. Nobody has allowed me to do that yet. But really, I think writing and sort of coming up with jokes and stories and worlds and characters, the impetus comes from the same place, I think. And the skill set has a huge overlap. You know, writing barks for a video game, which is a really weird gaming term. The barks are the lines that characters just say as you walk past them in games.
Right.
So that things, you know, as you're walking through a village in a video game, you'll hear the people saying the often quite cheesy things like, I hear the king is sick, and those sorts of lines that just have to try and fill out the color of the world. And they're really hard to write. And you know, it's the great skill of video game writers trying to come up with those, well, you know, must have been the wind, those sorts of things that people say in games. It's hard to find ones to do it in a way that isn't cheesy. And the sitting down and trying to write a list of things like that, how similar is that to trying to write a series of topical jokes in preparation for a something, Mock the Week's been cancelled, but something like that, one of those, a TV or a radio show, you go, okay, well, I'm going to need 5 one-liners about this subject. How do I do that in a way that's interesting? You know, it's the same. And I would say also, I'm not particularly good at either of those, but I do think it's the same skill. It's the same part of the brain is in use.
You've done a couple of those panel shows, right? What are they like to do?
I've done a handful of Mock the Weeks, less than a handful, 2, 3, maybe, I think. Did I do 4? I can't remember now. And it's been cancelled. So whatever number it is, it's not going up. That was a very good experience for me. It's hard work, but I think it's. I find it a lot easier on the radio because it's like recording a podcast, but also because I've edited video and I've edited lots of audio. With radio, I can edit in my head as I'm talking in a way.
Sure.
Obviously, you don't get to edit the radio shows. They do that, and they're very good, and they know how to do it. But if you're in front of a live audience, and perhaps you don't have this experience, Martin, from what you said, if something goes, like if something bombs, if something doesn't work, there's a sort of sense of, okay, so just gotta, never mind, move on, that's fine. But everybody here remembers that I said that thing that wasn't funny. And the same, that is always true in a live environment, but in a recording, it's just going to get edited out. Like if you do a joke that doesn't work, it's just going to get edited out. It doesn't matter. You know, nobody will ever hear it. So you don't have to worry about, oh, what if they hear the bad jokes? Because they will take those out of the edit. That feels like a little sort of mental safety net.
For me.
You just go like, well, I'm just sort of, well, that's gone. That's definitely not getting in the show. And when something goes well, you're going, well, maybe that's getting in the edit. And by the end, hopefully, you've just got all of the things that might get in the edit in your mind, and you can ignore all the things that definitely won't.
What's it like performing at Edinburgh Fringe?
I like Edinburgh a lot. Mm. It's really hard work, and you'll hear comedians sort of moan about it and complain about it, and rightly so, because you know it's oh, the whole thing is a scam, and everybody claims to be losing money, but someone must be making it, and we don't know who that person is. But if we find them, we're gonna kill them. Like, I'm just gonna just tear them to pieces. It doesn't sound like it should be that much work. Well, doing 25 shows in a row, you know, that's, so what? You're a comedian. That's your job. Fair enough. And this is me voicing your criticism. It doesn't sound like that much work. What, working for 1 hour a day for a month? And yet, it is more than that. You do way more than just your own show when you're at the Fringe. But there is a psychic strain to being examined that, you know, that intensely. You know, so the idea that there's, even if they're not there, the idea that reviewers and industry people and movers and shakers and decision makers might be coming to your, I didn't mean to rhyme there, it came out really good, I think.
It did.
Yeah. The idea that they might be there is a sort of a mental strain. And so people, and, you know, late nights, drinking culture, you know, bad food, people can really mess themselves up at the Fringe, I think. And it can be, if you're having a bad time, it can be very, very miserable. But that's the context for me to say I've always had a pretty nice time, and I like it. So I guess just a little bit more stable and probably a better person than most comedians.
It must be a weird venue, because I've heard that sometimes you're performing in like a fish and chip shop or a shipping donor.
Yeah, yeah. No, if you can't tell jokes while someone puts pepperoni on a pizza 2 feet away. Yes, there are some marvelous, marvelous venues, of course, and there are many fringes. You know, there's the free fringes and lots of different places to perform. But and perhaps because it does seem to be on the wane at the moment, because it's massively overpriced, and so the audiences are staying away. I hope they're going to do something about that, because it's a real, real shame. But yes, when it was at its peak, everywhere that could be a venue was a venue, and everywhere that could not be a venue also was a venue. So if you are going up for the first time, if you're a comedian who happens to be listening and is thinking about doing it, be quite selective, be thoughtful about where you're going to make a show, because some places are simply unplayable and it might be better not to do a show in them.
I guess the promotion for the show must be the hardest task in Edinburgh. because there's just so much vying for people's attention, and you're there with your flyers putting them up.
Yes, yeah, and the environmental cost of the flyers. I feel so bad about it. Yeah, I talked about doing an hour's work, but if you're flyering before a show, that is very tiring. It's very similar to maybe I find it tiring because I'm not naturally sociable, but being friendly and talking to strangers for 2 hours, I need to lie down after that, not to perform a show. But of course, if you don't want to do it yourself, you have to pay someone else to do it. And, you know, it all adds up. It's very difficult to compete. I was lucky this year gone, because it was the first time I'd done the Fringe since having a bit of a profile bump with my online videos and with Mock the Week and other things. So people who hadn't seen me before but did know me through that other stuff were coming along for the first time. So I found that it sold remarkably easy by comparison with previous years. Also, because I was in, you know, not a very large room. I was in the same room I'd been in previously, you know, a nice small room that filled up quite nicely, which was a real treat. Because I tell you what, doing comedy when there's an audience there is really different to when it's just three people with their arms folded.
I think Alan Davis once told a story where he went on Edinburgh Fringe and there was three people there and the couple at the front said, should we just leave?
I think every comedian has been in that situation. And weirdly, those gigs can be magical. You know, I'd rather have a gig in front of three oddballs who want it than a room full of people not laughing.
So you mentioned you've written a book. Have you been bitten by the writing bug?
Yeah, I'm forced to do it by a contract. So whether or not I want to write more books, I have to. Fortunately, I am quite enjoying it, but it is hard work. And there are more words in a book than there are in a stand-up comedy show, I have since learned. Because I thought there'd be a similar amount of work, and they're not. And I'm talking about a kid's book as well. So that's like a quarter of the length of an adult's book. In February, Montgomery Bonbon Murder at the Museum came out earlier this year, which is a whodunit, a middle grade whodunit. And middle grade means that it's for, I think, 8 to 12-year-olds. But I like it because I think it sounds to me like it means that it's just kind of mediocre. You know, like I wrote a middle grade book, which I feel like that sets the bar, because then people will be like, oh, this is actually quite good. And then they'll be impressed. So it's a whodunit. It's a murder mystery for kids. And I've written another one that's coming out in later this year, October, September, something like that, around back to school times. And then there's going to be more after that as well. The premise of the book is that Bonnie Montgomery, a 10-year-old girl, is a brilliant detective, but kids aren't really allowed to investigate murders. So she investigates murder as Montgomery Bonbon, the mysterious foreign detective, who's a little bit like Poirot with the accent and the mustache and the beret. But she's not very good at doing the accent, so it goes all over the place.
That should be an animated series.
I agree. Yeah, phone up Netflix and the Amazon Primes and tell them to give me some money for an animated series.
Oh, my daughter's in that age bracket, so I'll definitely get that for her.
Oh, yes, please do.
So what's next for you? I mean, obviously you're touring now. Have you got any aspirations to maybe write or direct some TV?
Well, I would. Obviously, I've never been cast in actual telly Doctor Who, and I have. There's no reason I should have been. I'm not an actor, but I am still slightly annoyed. Like, it's not like I've never auditioned for anything. I'm not an actor, but I am still, I feel like by now I should have been in it. And that's slightly annoying. Started doing stand-up because I wanted to direct or make my own dramas. And, I, you know, like most comedians have a drawer full of sitcom pilot scripts and treatments and short film ideas. And I'd like to be able to get back to that. I'd like to do that at some point, because it was what I spent all of my 20s trying to do, and then I dropped it to do stand-up because stand-up was way easier. That's not good. I shouldn't say that. It's not that stand-up was easier. It's much easier. When I started doing stand-up and people, I would say things and people laughed, that is immediately recognized as stand-up. Stand-up is like the world of comedy is hardly fair. It's not a meritocracy, you know. It's got its nasty elements to it, but it is also quite broad-minded by comparison with some other areas. Like, if you can go on stage and make people laugh for 20 minutes, people don't really mind. You know, you can work as a comedian. When I was trying to make films and things, you know, the I'd be submitting scripts and the feedback you get would be just like, why are you interested in this? And why did you expect we would be? Why? You know, if you've ever pitched anything, you might have heard that thing from the feedback where people go, okay, well, this is an interesting idea, but why now? Why should we make this now? And it's like, I don't know, because I'm alive now? What do you want to do as a sort of kind of post-mortem retrospective? Because I just wrote the script. Why? I'm just a flashback there. I found that very difficult to deal with, whereas comedy, I could do it, and it was nice.
Excellent. So you incorporate a lot of music into your show. Is that something that you're passionate about?
Well, I like music, but I am extremely musically ignorant myself. So I'm very not musical. So in the interdimensional ABK theme tune is sung and orchestrated, if that's the word, by Lawrence Owen, who is a musical genius and a podcaster. He podcasts as Long Cat Media with his partner. They do brilliant sort of semi-comic mystery drama podcasts like Mockery Manor and a new one called Ghosted, which I think if you enjoyed Redacted would be very much up your street.
I think I've heard of that, yeah.
I have a couple of lines in Mockery Manor series 2, I think. if anyone wants to just listen to podcasts that I do a few lines in, then that's one.
I think I first saw you on YouTube. How did you get into making videos?
Well, I started doing it before lockdown, having been warned by the Illuminati that it was coming. I came back from the Edinburgh Fringe in 2019 with a sense that I'd done a good show, but I hadn't moved my career forwards, which is quite a common experience at the Fringe. You can go up with quite high expectations, and just doing a good show is should be enough, but doesn't always feel like it is. So I came back and I bought a secondhand camera. I thought, I'm going to start filming bits that were in this show and bits of new material. I'm going to stick them up online. And I'll stick them up online, and I'll do that thing where you film a gig from the back. And I'll put that online. And to date, I have never filmed a gig from the back of the room with that camera. I just started doing sketches with it. And it wasn't until lockdown happened that any of my sketches took off, really. I guess because just more people were stuck in front of their screen. So I was very lucky that we were all trapped indoors, in spite of how unpleasant it was for everyone. It really worked out well for me.
Yeah.
And for a while, I did about a video a week, and then it became a video every 2 weeks. And now we're back to normal. It's a video. I'm editing one today. I am trying to make them, please.
I'm ready, all right?
It'll be done when it's done. But I didn't realize how much, I set a precedent that is impossible to maintain while also being on a national tour. Unfortunately.
No.
But it was nice because I had, you know, skills. Like, I can animate. I know how to use cameras. I'm not very good with mics. I've got a little bit better at recording sound. But I was just by chance, I was a few weeks ahead of other comedians who suddenly had to try and learn these things from scratch. Well, I studied some of these things. So that's why when you watch my videos, the eye lines match up as two different characters talk to each other. Whereas when you watch other people's online sketches, the eye lines are all over the place sometimes.
That must be a nightmare to get right.
You just need to remember to preserve the line of action. And if you know what the line of action is, it's the film version of the offside rule. Like, everyone who knows what it is knows what it is, and everyone who doesn't, it's impossible to explain it.
It's a good point.
I would try and explain it, but I've just remembered that this is an audio medium, and the one thing that it's hard enough to explain with miming, but if you're in a podcast, you definitely can't explain line of action.
Alistair, you've been very generous with your time, but I'm going to let you go.
Thank you. Sorry for ending on such a boring note.
Where do you tell people where they can find you online and find information about the tour?
If you Google or use any search engine, if you hop on the old Bing and type in the interdimensional ABK, you hopefully will find the animated intro that I created. And there should be somewhere in the vicinity of that a link to buy tickets to see the show. I'm doing it all over the place in England, a couple of dates in Scotland, and a couple in Northern Ireland, and none in Wales. As I'm the opposite of Doctor Who in that I will not go to Cardiff. That isn't true. That's not true. But and I know he's not called Doctor Who. He's called the Doctor. Please don't send me emails. And you can find my YouTube channel, abeckettking.com. There is every episode of Popular Time Travel Show, I think it's called, is a sketch that's a Doctor Who spoof that I did. And so you might enjoy that, or you might be furious, depending on what kind of fan you are. And yeah, I'm on Twitter at Mr. ABK until it burns to the ground. It will probably happen before you finish editing this.
Well, I just kind of like that he's acting exactly how I expect a billionaire to act.
I remember years ago, literally years ago, having disagreements with two friends about whether or not he was a wanker. And my evidence, I had no evidence at all. I just had a feeling. And because he was a billionaire, so I was like, yeah, so he must be a wanker. And they were like, no, he's cool. He's like, he invented a flamethrower. It's like, it sounds like something a wanker would do. And then he called that guy a pedophile, and then he bought Twitter. And I was like, and I'm every day I just wake up thinking, maybe they will apologize today. I was right.
And on that note,
needless to say, I had the last laugh. What an arrogant man that ABK is.
Thank you for listening to the Bad Wolf Podcast. For information on Alistair's tour, please check out his website linked below.